This is Colourful.
I want to give you a little insight into the book that we're going to be covering right now. It's called I and I, The Natural Mystics, and it examines for the first time the history and development of the Wailers and the overlapping stories of each member in detail. Grant argues in the book that these reggae stars offered a model for black men in the second half of the 20th century. Accommodate and succeed, that was Marley. Fight and die, Tosh. Or retreat and live, Wailer. It charts their complex relationship, fortunes, musical peak, and the politics and ideologies that provoked their split in the mid-1970s. Following their trail from Jamaica through Europe, America, Africa, and back to the vibrant and volatile world of Trenchtown, Colin Grant travels in search of the last remaining Wailer. He unravels the roots of their charisma, their adoption of the cult of Rastafari, their suspicion of race pimps and Obia men, and illuminates why the Wailers were not just extraordinary musicians, but also natural mystics.
Welcome to Colin Grant. How are you?
Pretty good. I can't really improve on what you just said, actually.
You know, I was just thinking about race pimps and Obia men. I'm just wondering if I know either. Do you know any, Colin?
I'm afraid I do, yes. I won't be naming them today, though.
No. It's not about that. What it is about is explaining, first of all, why you felt the need to do this, to search out this natural mystic and to uncover something that many out there who feel they know the story of the Wailers, certainly know the story of Bob Marley, have already heard this.
Well, we all know so many stories about Bob Marley. There have been so many books written, so many features written in newspapers and magazines. But what about the other two? What about Peter Tosh and Bunny Wailer? Peter Tosh and Bunny Wailer were together with Bob Marley for 10 years. Mm-hmm. They were a band of brothers. They lived hand in glove. They went through serious privation in the Trenchtown ghetto of Kingston. And they soared. They were wonderful musicians. Each one of them was equally talented, equally committed, equally spiritual. And yet we know about one, and the other two were eclipsed. And it's a remarkable story in that for 10 years they were together, and right at that moment when they're going to become international stars now, the wheels come off, and only one is elevated at the expense of the other two. So I want to get to the bottom of that. Why was that the case? Why was Marley elevated and the other two forgotten? As the man says, as the reggae singers sing, half the story has never been told. This is the other half.
Ah. You know what I'm thinking? I'm thinking about how you start the book in 1990. It was a very, very thoughtful way of starting it right there. I suppose in a way, a clash of two Jamaicas, a clash of two cultures, two powerful moments.
But the old and the new.
Mm.
The old and the new. I see on your board you have here, old school is the new cool.
Well, old school is the new cool.
Too new cool.
What we're trying to say, what we're trying to say is that we know that new stars, whether in reggae, roots, R&B, are born every year. But we have to respect where they got their inspiration from, where it all came from. Many forget today, and I suppose that's why you started at that point, on that stage in 1990.
Exactly. 1990, a very dramatic moment in Jamaican music, a very dramatic moment in Jamaican history. By 1990, Brother Bob is dead. Peter Tosh has been murdered. Of the three, there's only one last remaining Wailer, Bunny Wailer. And there's been a call for the singers to come back because the music's been taken over by dancehall, which is very, very, very vibrant, wonderful music, but actually sometimes it's full of slackness and sex and guns. And there's been a call for the social consciousness of the old school reggae to come back and for Bunny Wailer to stand up and make a stand. And he comes to this concert, the Sting Festival, a night of great reggae. But at that festival, there are other musicians, other DJs present. He's going to come on before Shabba Ranks and Ninja Man.
Mm.
And that's what the crowd are waiting for. They're waiting for a lyrical clash between these two giants of contemporary Jamaican music. And Bunny Wailer comes on, as it's Jamaica, it comes on rather late in the day, at 5 o'clock in the morning.
5 hours, 7 hours too late.
Yeah, so the crowd are a bit itchy, shall we say. And they've had their rum and coke and they've had their Aki and saltfish, but they want to hear Shabba, Ninja. Anyway, Bunny comes on and he sings some old school reggae, some of the songs that you and I will be familiar with.
Yep.
Wonderful songs. The crowd don't want to hear that. They want to hear the new stuff and they start to jeer him. And eventually he comes to the end of the stage. He tells the band to put their instruments down and he starts to argue with the crowd, reminding them that he is one of the giants of reggae, reminding them that he has put Jamaica on the map. And it being Jamaica, These young people in the crowd throw bottles and stones and rocks. They bottle him off the stage. He has to leave in a hurry. And this is a giant. This is one of the kings of reggae. And the next day in the Jamaican newspapers, that event is portrayed almost as an obituary. It was a real deathly moment.
Can I just read our listeners just a little piece here at that moment that you're talking about? It says, Bunny Wailer came to the edge of the stage, his face ablaze with fury and rage. Did they not know his pedigree? Did they not feel privileged by his attendance? Shouldn't the elders of reggae, he was 43 at that time, be revered? Had he not helped put Jamaica on the map? Hadn't he toiled for years without recognition, made huge sacrifices? He had not fashioned music to soothe the soul and raise the spirits. Well, no more. His litany of disbelief was interrupted. The first bottle pierced the night air, whistled past his head and landed a few feet behind him. It acted as a release and a salvo of missiles followed. The air was thick with beer bottles, cans, rocks and stones. The dancers and the band members ran for cover. For a while, Bunny Wailer was immobilised. Then roadies rushed to shield him from the onslaught of yet more bottles and bricks and he was ushered from the stage.
Wow. So from that moment, where do you go?
Well, from that moment, I travel back. Thinking of it almost as a film to how they began, because these three young boys were unknown at the start of their careers. They met in Trenchtown, in the ghetto, the Rock, a place where they'd come to where there was much privation, when there wasn't even a great sewage system. This is a place where people would rise in the early hours of the morning and deposit their feces in little bags. They called them scandal bags, and then have to deposit them at the edge of town. But they'd come from country. There were country boys come to town. And these are the sort of boys who lived very hard life in the country, the sort of life where they would have to cut up car tires to use as shoes.
Yeah.
They would use banana leaves as umbrellas and mango stones as cricket balls. But they came to Kingston, to the capital, where many, many musicians came to try their luck.
How did they come, you know?
Well, they came on buses, they came on jute buses, they walked, they got there eventually. And it was a crowded place, but it was a very vibrant place. Bunny Wailer says it was almost like a Hollywood place. It had so many potential stars there. Because Jamaica is full of stars. On the street, you go to Jamaica, everybody's singing, everybody has talent.
Yeah.
But these boys had even more talent, but they had to work hard. And they were very fortunate because there was a man in that ghetto called Joe Higgs, who was a Rastafarian and a great musician, and he taught them harmony.
Right.
And he gave them their first moment of an audition. They went to Cox and Dawdon and they performed. And it was quite a difficult time because he'd coached them really hard. And they went along and they played some songs and Coxon was shaking his head, didn't like any of them. And they went back and they said they'd failed. And Joe Higgs said, well, what about Simmer Down? Didn't you play Simmer Down? And they said, no, because Marley didn't actually like Simmer Down. He thought it was too much of a nursery rhyme. But they went back, they played Simmer Down, and within the first few moments, Coxon Dawdon said, that's the one. And from there, they're on their way.
Colin, where do you find Bunny Wailer? You know, and how is he when you find him?
Bunny Wailer is the original mystic man. He's a very mysterious man, but he's a very soulful, spiritual man, and had become, over the years, a bit of a recluse. Not because he needs to be, not because he's shying away from publicity, but actually he likes to live on his land. He likes to tend his chickens and plant his crops. So it took me quite a while to find him. It was quite a merry dance that he led me.
Yeah, I want to know where you found him, whereabouts in Jamaica, because obviously you're taking him back to the early 60s and you're sitting there. I don't know if you're smoking herb, but you're discussing, you're reasoning and maybe doing a bit of Naya Bingi. I don't know what you're doing.
He's in St. Thomas, isn't he?
It would be so dramatic if it was that wonderful. But actually, I chased him around Jamaica. I couldn't find him in Jamaica. I knew where he was, but he couldn't get to him.
Okay.
I sat in cars at the appointed hour for many, many hours waiting. Having been brought there by middlemen, never show. After about 2 years, I get a phone. I'm back in England now. I get a phone call on a Thursday night saying, if you want to meet Bunny, get to Gatwick Airport at 10 o'clock tomorrow morning.
Right.
So I got to Gatwick Airport and I met him on his tour bus. And there was plenty of stimulation there, shall we say. But we focused on the music and we focused on the legacy of the man, because actually, when you meet him, he's almost like a man who's practiced yoga for years and years and years. He's very chilled, very relaxed, and almost a man grounded. He's not really worried about the world around him. He's so focused on himself and focused on his communion with Jah. And you got that just from talking with him. Mm-hmm. I felt I was talking with Jah at one stage because he's so joined up. You know, he sings the praise of God. He sings the praise of his fallen compadres. And that's his life. He's a very, very serious fellow. Not to say he doesn't smile.
Yeah.
He has a delicious smile. He has a delicious way of speaking. He's very speaky-spoky, we say in Jamaica. Mm-hmm. He's almost like a
like
man.
You.
Speaky-spoky from Kingston 6 or whatever he is.
Yeah, he's a great orator, like my other great hero, Marcus Mosiah Garvey.
Yes.
Bunny Whaley has a silver tongue.
Aha. So rather than being among his chicken, goats and whatever on his land in Jamaica, in St. Thomas or wherever it is, you're on his tour bus and you're talking to him. And how is he when you take him back to some of these early days? And how willing is he to talk about some of the more difficult bits, especially early on?
Well, Bunny Whaley, whenever he performs on stage, he tries to conjure his fallen compadres, these great musicians, Peter Tosh and Bob Marley. Mm-hmm. And together with him, they had what the Spanish call duende, this ability to transmit a profoundly felt emotion. So he loves to conjure, he loves to traffic with his fallen compadres. And the one time that the conversation became awkward was when I reminded him of that terrible event in 1990. Mm-hmm. And Bunny, being a proud man, was rather humiliated by that moment. Mm. But actually, he turned it around, as so many Jamaicans do. He turned it into a positive thing, because he said that night there was going to be a terrible clash between the two sets of fans, the Ninja Man fan club and the Shabaranx fans. And they're going to beat up each other. But instead, they turned on him. So in a way, he sees himself as this sacrificial figure who took the sting out of Sting.
Wicked.
Colin Grant right here talking about I and I, the Natural Mystics. And I'm just wondering then about the dynamic between the three and the difference in how they represented and what we should be taking from them now, looking back at their contribution, not just musically, but I suppose ethically, socially, how to live.
Well, as you said in the introduction, they were down the line Rastas. They were mountain Rastafarians. I interviewed a man for the book called Benjamin Foote, who acted as their tour manager in the early 70s when they were unknown here in the UK. And they would go up and down the motorway in this little beaten up van. And he said, the tour manager said, these three guys, Bunny, Peter and Bob, were arguing non-stop. But they weren't arguing about girls, Juju. They weren't arguing about the running order of songs. They were arguing over scripture.
Wow.
They lived and breathed the Rastafarian religion. And they lived this idea of liberty, this idea that you can spurn commercial wealth and lead a spiritual life close to the earth. But they were fundamentally three kinds of black man who were like bulls in a paddock. They grew up like bulls in a paddock. And at some moment towards the end of that 10 years together, Chris Blackwell, this white Jamaican entrepreneur, boss of Island Records, comes and lifts the latch and takes Bob with him and leaves the other two behind. But actually they represent three kinds of brothers. Bunny Whaley, this very quiet man, seemingly quiet man, but actually a very deep and resonant man, who'd rather, as you say, plant his crops and feed his chickens and not go on tour. Famously didn't want a tour. And then you had Bob Marley, a fair-skinned, photogenic black man who was able to accommodate the needs of the bosses. Not to say that he was going to sell out. He didn't sell out, but he was going to be more practical than the other two, perhaps.
Mm.
And Chris Blackwell thought he could do business with him.
Yeah.
And then Peter Tosh, the most militant guy, tall, black, seemingly always angry, wore dark
glasses. Fight and die.
And he frightened people nonstop. They couldn't read him. But actually, I think Peter Tosh was the most hilarious, funny comic man of them all.
Mm-hmm.
Bob Marley, Screwface, very serious man, equally Bunny Whaley. But Peter Tosh was a wit. He was a very famous wit, very careful wit. There was this moment when they'd left the band, when they split in 74, 75, and in 78, Peter Tosh joins the Rolling Stones on tour, because they've gone to see him and they think he's a remarkable fellow. But they didn't pay him, in his mind, they didn't pay him enough for his services. At one stage, Keith Richards had a house in Jamaica, and in lieu of payment, Peter Tosh captured the house. And Keith Richards heard about this, and he gets on a plane, he gets to Montego Bay Airport, and he rings from the airport and says, "Peter, get out of my house, I'm coming." And Peter says, "Come now, come if you're bad, I'm ready for you, I have a gun, I'm ready." And Keith Richards says, "Well, you better put lots of bullets in that gun, and you better take the safety catch off, because I'm on my way." And by the time Keith Richards came to that house, Peter had fled. So,
he fled from Keith Richards.
And that's, by way of example, has shown that actually he was a man of front. Yeah. You had to have front in Jamaica. So he wasn't a hard man. He had this front as a hard man. He was a very sensitive poet. And I think I want to remind people about that, but also to remind people of his comedy. That's forgotten.
This is from Rosaline. She's Facebooked us. She's listening. Bob Marley, his message, peace, love and harmony all around the world to all, regardless of age, race, gender, religion or political views. People are people.
I did mention this earlier this morning, just after seven. This is one of the sexiest book covers I've seen in a long time. It's a book that if you was in Waterstones and you just notice it, you think, I want that, before you even really know what it's about, because the pictures on the front is brilliant. It's just so classy, and the material that you use. Did you have any part in the look of the book?
Yeah, we wanted it to look like an old LP.
Yeah.
So we have the title in the middle, like the middle of a record, and the guy's name there, and I'm privileged to be on the same page as Bunny, Peter and Bob. And then these guys in 1974 or 75, and they're wearing their battle fatigues, and they're cool, man. They're cool, they're ancient cool. They're so photogenic. But I was equally determined to put the story right on this idea that Bob Marley was some kind of white man, because that actually has been proposed down the line, down the years, that he was able to get on because he was virtually white. Bob Marley apparently famously said, when he was asked about his race, because he had a so-called white father — I say so-called because in Jamaica we say he was touched by the tar brush, the father — a so-called white father and black mother. Therefore, he was asked, which race did he belong to when he was famous? And he said, I dip on neither one side nor the other. But my friend, no one in Jamaica, in Kingston, Trench Town, becomes a Rastafarian in the 1960s unless they 100% identify with being black. So let's get that story straight. Bob Marley is a righteous black man.
One thing I want to put across, because I was just talking to Colin off air, is that, you know, you say, Colin, that this is a book of entertainment and fun, and as well as, you know, all the deep spiritual stuff. I suppose we're kind of on a spiritual tip at the moment because we're in awe of the things that you're saying and interest and whatnot. But there is some laughs in it, isn't there?
Oh, absolutely. Because actually these three guys, as teenagers, they were rhythm and blues guys. They wore two-tone suits and had brill cream hair before they had dreadlocks. And in Jamaica, the way to get a break at that time would be to appear on this variety show called Opportunity Hour, rather like Britain's Got Talent. It wasn't televised, but it's a theatre show. And Bob, Peter and Bunny performed with these other kinds of strange performers, rumba dancers, tumblers, acrobats. And when they performed one of their first songs, Peter, Bunny and Bob, dressed in these two-tone suits, the crowd went wild. They jumped in the air, they tried to reach them, and they were so enthralled that they showered the stage with coins. And Peter says that after they finished their set, the crowd realised that they were just as poor as the boys on stage, and they came and begged back the money.
Absolutely tremendous. Morning, Henry and Gigi. I listen to Colourful as it caters to my taste in music as a 40-something woman who loves her reggae and soul and any form of music that is uplifting and politically conscious. And then she goes on in some detail, and we'll read the rest of this out a little bit later on about just why she likes the shows on this station and why she's so wedded to it, which is great. But this is one of the reasons why we're so keen to have you in, Colin, because you feel, a lot of people feel, they have heard this story, but there is so much else that you feel is there and you put it in the book.
I think so, because not being disrespectful to many of my music journalist brothers then, I think they just focus on the old stories and they don't get to the social history, they don't get to the texture behind these stories. How did these guys emerge? What was life really like for someone growing up in Jamaica, in post-independence Jamaica? And that's what I like to explore. But also some of the little snippets that you hear about in some of these books, like, for instance, the story that Bob Marley for many months wouldn't speak to people in the mid-1960s, that they didn't know what was wrong with him. And some books say he was depressed. But I know that there are people there who would have been jealous of Bob Marley and would have put a spell on him, would have gone to an obeah. There's lots of track with obeah in Jamaica, this idea that you can use what a man or woman's strength has and turn it against them.
Yeah.
So I went to explore, what is obeah? How does obeah still thrive in Jamaica, which it does? So I would go and see this man, Brother D, in St. Thomas. And I was struck by the fact that everybody I spoke to, almost off record, believed in obeah. And Peter Tosh and Bunny and Bob believed in Obeah. They didn't like Obeah, but they believed in it. So the story that Peter Tosh often was spoken of, a man who believed that there was duppies out there, there were spirits out there who were going to go and get him. Mm-hmm. And he would lie in bed and the duppy would lie on his chest, would try to strangle him, to take his life force away from him. Now, what Peter Tosh was doing, he said that when he felt this force on his chest, he would batter away the demon with all the expletives that he could conjure. Mm-hmm. But what Peter Tosh actually suffered from was something called sleep paralysis, which many adolescents suffer from. That moment when you've just fallen asleep, but you're not quite fully asleep, and you kind of wake up, but you can't move. You're semi-paralyzed. So I explore all those sorts of details, which are never really talked about in the book. And this idea that actually each one of them could have been the one was explored also in the way that sometimes in Jamaica, people shun conventional Western medicine. Yes. And look to healers. So I was interested in why Bob, Brother Bob, didn't initially want to have any kind of truck with Western medicine when he had the melanoma on his toe. Yeah. And he'd rather try to heal himself. And I go a bit deeper than some of other books have been, I think. Marcus Mazar Garvey, a great black nationalist hero, was admired, revered by Peter, Bunny and Bob, because as I'm sure many of your listeners know, Marcus Mazar Garvey served as John the Baptist to Haile Selassie's Jesus Christ. And Garvey had always said, look to the east, princes shall come out of Egypt and God shall turn its hands unto Ethiopia. And lo and behold, in 1930, Haile Selassie was crowned emperor of Ethiopia. And when Haile Selassie came to Jamaica in 1966, and I talk about this in the book, he was shocked by the tens of thousands of Rastafarians who were on the tarmac at the airport in Jamaica, Kingston, to greet him. So shocked that actually he didn't want to get out of the plane. And I talk in the book about this wonderful Rasta intellectual called Mortimer Plano. Mortimer Plano, you have to remember, in Jamaica, in Kingston, there was no university that anyone could go to if you had no money. Mm. And these guys who lived in the ghetto, there were street intellectuals like Mortimer Plano who taught them many, many things. They were elders. And when Selassie was stranded on this plane, the authorities were petrified and they called on the loudspeaker for Plano to come. He climbed the steps of the plane and then he turned his back to the plane. And rather like Moses parting the Red Sea, he commanded the people to move.
You got fascinating pictures in this book, and that is one of them. You got Mortimer Plano there as he's persuading the masses to clear the path for Haile Selassie. And you can see him descending down the steps in Jamaica in 1966. But you've also got some other brilliant photos throughout the book. You've got Lee Scratch Perry, you've got pictures of Chris Blackwell, Joe Higgs, who you mentioned, wearing the beret that rarely left his head. And Higgs was the first and lasting mentor of the three Trenchtown Utes. And you've got pictures of them at that opportunity hour that you said was like the Britain's Got Talent. It's just such a beautiful book. I know that I'm gushing, but it really is. I can't wait to read it.
Well, thank you. Well, it's one of the few times I actually enjoy reading my own book. I wrote the book on Marcus Garvey, which is a deep book, a very thick book.
On Negro with a Hat.
Negro with a Hat. But Marcus Garvey was the kind of giant that you mentioned. These guys were standing on the shoulders of Marcus Mazar Garvey. But they were so committed to what Garvey was saying, so committed to the side of Rasta, that Bunny Willis says that when Selassie came, we stopped the kind of dance hall, whorehouse life. No more drinking beer, no more nightclub vibe. We took a Nazarite vow, neither to drink nor cut our hair.
Wow. Mm-hmm. And they managed to, well, I say, I'm just thinking about Bob's life in particular. Break that down,
yeah,
please.
Yeah, well, there was a bit of slippage occasionally, but I think at heart they fundamentally held to that idea, that core idea. But they learned so much from this guy, Plano, and I was intrigued by the fact that he had an open yard. He had a kind of night school for Rasta, for the understanding of black and African history. And that's where Bob, Bunny and Peter went regularly to learn from the feet of this great elder. In a way, this guy, Mortimer Plano, he acted as kind of Elijah Muhammad acted to Muhammad Ali. Remember when Muhammad Ali changed from Cassius Clay to Muhammad Ali after he won that title, heavyweight title? And he proselytized on behalf of the Nation of Islam. Yeah. In the same way, Bunny, Peter and Bob proselytized on behalf of Rasta. And it's kind of intriguing to me the way that Rasta and reggae rose together, hand in hand in a way. And the demise of Rasta has kind of mirrored the demise of old school reggae.
Mm-hmm. I'm just wondering about the big commercial machine that Chris Blackwell opened Bob in particular onto, and the degree to which that tore the trio asunder. I'm just wondering how their raster consciousness survived that, particularly Bob's.
Well, it was difficult because in a way it's a kind of contradiction, isn't it, to lead the spiritual life but then to be showered with millions of dollars.
Yeah.
To have all these girls at your concert who would lay down with you at the flick of an eyelid.
Mm.
So he was tempted on many occasions, and he loved women and he loved children. Yeah. But actually, fundamentally, I think he was a serious man, and he kind of kept that seriousness going. There are many, many women who can testify to his abilities as a lover. And I'm sure Esther Anderson won't mind me mentioning the fact.
Yes, let's talk about Esther briefly.
Esther Anderson is wonderful. Actress, musician, photographer. She met Marley in the early 70s. She'd been in Hollywood films. She'd acted with Sidney Poitier.
Yes,
and she became a tour manager. And she's a wonderful lady. If you come to my launch on Thursday, you'll see her. Mm-hmm. And she tells the story about some of the origins of the song. So, for instance, people know about the song I Shot the Sheriff. And Bob Marley talks about the fact that when the wheels were coming off the original band, here we go.
Had to be done. Had to be done, mate. Had to be done.
He had to shoot all Sheriff because the band were arguing. And that was the roots to that song. But Esther tells a different story. Esther tells a story that Bob Marley wanted her to have a baby. Bob Marley liked to procreate. He didn't want anyone to put a cap on his desire.
Yes.
But Esther had a coil. She had a coil fitted. She didn't want to have a baby. She was in the peak of her career. He argued with her. He harangued her. She went to the doctor, seemingly to have the coil removed. But unbeknownst to Brother Bob, she started taking contraceptive pills. And when Brother Bob found out about this, he was livid.
Yeah.
And so when he sings a song, when he sings the line, "Every time I plant the seed, you kill it before it grow," refers to the fact that he wanted her to be pregnant and she didn't.
Oh. And of course, Esther Anderson has a documentary, a very intimate portrayal of her time with Bob, coming out later on this year, doesn't she?
Yeah, she has a snippet of it in March at the BFI, mm-hmm. and later in May as well, the bigger event in May and June.
Uh-huh. And I'm just thinking then, as we go through the 70s, what's happening to the trio? We know Peter Tosh, unfortunately, met his end very prematurely. But I'm just thinking about that natural mystic, them as a trio, and what we should see them as representing today. Because as you said earlier, three very different types of men, three different messages. You know, you can accommodate, you can succeed, you can fight, you can go away and tend your lambs.
Well, as my mother, Ethelyn Grant, would say, "Hello, Mum. We're only passing through. This world is not my resting place." And I think these guys adhere to that in their songs, in their philosophy. But they were out to right some wrongs as well. And one of the kind of key arguments in the book is the way that you can either accommodate or fight. Mm-hmm. You can either have one love or you can have rejection of love and some kind of retribution. So in a way, the argument between Bob Marley and Peter Tosh is played out famously at that concert in 1978, the One Love Peace concert, when there's virtual civil war in Jamaica.
Yeah.
And famously, people will know, Bob Marley comes on stage and he invites the Prime Minister and Edward Seaga to hold hands, this holy trinity, advocating unity. Jamaicans will then tell you that actually they were rather like Jesus Christ on the cross surrounded by the two thieves.
So, Manly and Seaga.
Manly and Seaga, bless them. I do love them actually. Mm. But anyway, at that same event where Bob has advocated one love, he's preceded on stage by Peter Tosh. And Peter Tosh comes on stage and he blows marijuana smoke in the faces of the politicians. He has a huge spliff on stage. And he's arguing about the shitstem, the corrupt system that's led to this terrible near civil war.
Mm-mm.
And Peter Tosh says, "Forget unity. Peace is the diploma you get in the cemetery." And so in a way, the book is an argument about which line one should take, unity or retribution.
Where do you go from here? Because, of course, you've talked about Negro with a Hat. Yeah, Marcus Mazzia Garvey. We move to the natural mystics. What next?
I've been commissioned to write a book called Bag Eye at the Wheel. Bag Eye was my father's nickname. My father's Jamaican. My mother's Jamaican.
Mm.
And my father had baggy eyes. They called him Bag Eye.
I love the way they do that in Jamaica. Well, it's in the Caribbean generally, isn't it? Bag Eye.
Bag Eye at the Wheel, because he had a minicab. He used to drive this little minicar, moonlight as a minicab driver, but he had no driving license. So I loved his entrepreneurship, and the book is going to be a kind of comic memoir of 1973-74 or thereabouts. And Bad Guy has his spars with him, his friends with him. There's Shine, who's rather like us, a ballad.
Ballad, yeah. Chase a funky ballad out of town.
Tidy Boots is very, very particular, very fastidious. Pumpkinhead has a pumpkin-shaped head. But my all-time favourite is a guy called Summer Wear. Summer Wear came to this country in the early 60s, and he always insisted on wearing light linen suits. And I asked my mum, whatever happened to Summer Wear? And she said, well, you know, he caught a cold and died.
Mr. Summer. Dear, I love that.
I'm wondering if I should use them lyrics, or if I'd have used them back in the day, if I'd have got stopped by the police when I was driving without a license, if I'd have said it's entrepreneurship, do you reckon I would have got away with it?
I suspect knowing your
not.
Luck, Juju, probably not.
Okay, the number, if you want to get involved, 0800 999 8090, still 11 minutes. That's free phone, 0800 999 8090. You were speaking to Bunny Wailer quite recently. I know in the past that he's been kind of people have had a go at him about his views on homosexuality. I wonder if that came up. Obviously, he's got a lot of axes to grind against dancehall music, which is the kind of music that normally gets the pressure and when it comes to these issues. But he's got these kind of issues too, still today in 2011. I don't know.
Yeah, I think we have to make the distinction between people reading their Bible and seeing things in the Bible and then talking amongst themselves, like church people talking about homosexuality being a disgrace, being an abomination. There's a difference between that and advocating people going out and killing homosexuals. And Bunny Wailer is not in that camp. Right. I think Bunny Wailer has the same kind of mindset as many Jamaicans when it comes to what they see as deviation. I don't think he differs very much from the majority of the population.
And just wondering as well about how modern Jamaicans in 2011, with all the problems they still have there, see this trio now. You know, because of course we had that watershed moment at the Sting Festival in 1990. That's 21 years ago. When you go back to Jamaica now and you mention the names, you talk about these natural mystics, you tell people what you're doing, that you're writing this book, what do they say?
Well, they still admire this trio. I think they still feel very proud because actually these guys did put Jamaica on the map.
Oh, yes.
This is a time when black people were kings, when reggae was king, and you wanted to be associated with them. This is a celebratory moment, and it's a kind of tragedy that the story's been turned away from that moment to dancehall and slackness and the suggestion of homophobia, because I don't think there is homophobia in the culture in the way that it's been portrayed. Uh-huh. I think ultimately these guys are spiritual guides, and they believe in the idea of respect for everyone.
Yeah.
And Bunny now has respect. That terrible moment, 1990, has been put to one side. And I think that people have come to realise that anyone who sticks around for this long and still keeps on that mantra of one love, of respect, of praise to Jah, of feeling that you are only here to do the work of God,
yes,
has to, at some level, be a man that you respect as well.
And what about you, Colin Grant, when it comes to those three types of men? So accommodate, you know, fight, or tend your chickens and goats. Which one best represents you?
Well, if I had some chickens and goats in Brighton where I live, I would be a happy man.
Okay.
And if I get one or two people to go to Smith's and tell them to start stocking the book.
Oh, really? Oh.
Then I might have some truck.
Well, that's where you might have to get into fight and die mode.
I think we all go through that, don't we, in this culture. We all have to think quite carefully about how we succeed in life. Mm. And I've been through those three stages. I've accommodated. I joined the BBC. I'm a BBC employee. Mm. But I've had my difficulties with the BBC. I've been occasionally invited for disciplinary hearings.
Really?
Were you Tosh or Marley on that day? Or Wailer?
He was probably accused of being Tosh.
I was Tosh on that day, but I was with my NUJ advisor, who was kicking me under the table, telling me not to be so disrespectful to my masters.
So remember, you're Marley.
Your masters or your masses.
Well, as we say in Jamaica, master day done. But what's curious to me is that, you know, with my spirit, and I think I have a kind of Jamaican indomitable spirit, that ultimately I think you have to stick and stay. And I think that's what Bob Marley was doing. I think he realised that actually he was going to try to do things. He was going to try and do two things. He was going to try and advocate what he really believed, but he was going to have to make some sort of accommodation in order to make that change. Mm. And I think you have to be in the system to make that change. But I think that what I really want to do is make sure that we don't have figures like Bob, Bunny and Peter appropriated by white culture. Because there's been a temptation, hasn't there, in the way that these guys have been written, to say, actually, Bob Marley was almost a kind of proto-white man. Mm-hmm. And I want people to recognise that black people can achieve something. And that's why I love these guys, because they recognise and they believe in themselves as black people, as spiritual people, making amends for the way that the black man was perceived as never, mm-hmm. ever having achieved anything. And so these guys are revered in Jamaica still, if mm-hmm. only for that.
And resonance all around the world still to this day.
Most definitely. One thing we haven't touched on, we've got 7 minutes left. We don't want to let you go at all. Colin, sorry if you thought this was going to be 20 minutes. but one thing we haven't touched on is money. And I know that it's one of the things that is often brought up in terms of Bunny Wailer and was he shafted by the Marley family. When you were talking to him recently, did you get a sense, or did he tell you blatantly if that was true or not?
Well, he's a very shrewd and modest man. We wouldn't talk about money. We talk about Dunzai. But let me let listeners know, Bunny Wailer is the shrewdest of them all. So when Bob, Bunny and Peter were going to cross over to Island Records, Chris Blackwell had to buy out their contract from Danny Sims of Jad Records. And Danny Sims, being a shrewd black man, also had his way because he argued that he should retain publishing rights to the songs, right? So In perpetuity.
Yeah. I love that word. It's not one of those words that trips off the tongue, is it, really?
No.
So what shrewd Bunny Wailer did when he wrote some of those original songs for Catch a Fire and Burning, he gave the credit to his long-term girlfriend, Judy Watt. And so when it came to copyrights, she had the copyright and not Danny Sims. And so he accrued a lot of money, thank you very much. Bunny Wailer is a very wealthy man, and he's a very wealthy man because he made some right decisions early on with Gene Watt and with Danny Sims.
This is Colourful.